Pittsburgh Section of National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2, Barbara Burns and Cindy Goodman Lee are interviewing Leah Slomberg, August the 10th, 1998. Leah, would you be kind enough to give us your address?
My address is 4625 Fifth Avenue, apartment 316, Pittsburgh, 15213.
And what section of the city is that?
That's in Oakland.
Okay, thank you. Leah, you mentioned just before we sat down that there were some items that we spoke about in the last interview that that we didn't elaborate on, and that you have more details and more information about them right now. And I know you're ready with them, so would you be kind enough to tell us?
Yes, I will. You had asked me about the name of the congregation in the Keys Rocks where my husband and my mother-in-law went to services, and the name seemed to elude me at that time, but now I can tell you that it's Ahavatachim, A-H-A-V-A-T-H-A-C-H-I-M. And then we were talking about our son, Martin, and the fact that he was a principal at Van School, and the school that he taught at before was Carmel in the Brookline area. I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. And now I have a question to ask
okay.
you.
Okay. Fine.
You had mentioned a Dr. Grecken.
Right. Dr. Grecken was our family physician when I was a little girl. I think I mentioned that I had been quite ill and hadn't attended school very often as a result of that. And Dr. Grecken was at our house regularly. In those days, doctors came to the homes. And he was a very compassionate man and very as helpful as he knew how to be without having penicillin or any of the modern drugs at his fingertips. I remember, and I may have mentioned this before, that all he could do for my fever was give me some kind of a powder dissolved in water and hope that it would take down my fever.
And it usually did?
Well, most of the time it did pretty well. Very often he came twice in one day to see me because he was concerned. I had at that time what they called Beeling ears, and they used a electric needle to puncture the ear, and he did that on a regular basis. And he would do it one day, and the next morning he was at the door to see how I was doing. So he was a wonderful, wonderful man.
It's certainly a rarity now.
A rarity indeed.
Another question I had for you when I was looking at my notes is you had mentioned that the IKC was on the corner, the IKS
mm-hmm.
was on the corner of Center and...
I don't remember. It was a big building down on Center Avenue, but I don't remember the side streets.
Fine.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that I had neglected to pick that up on the tape.
Mm-hmm. On Dinwiddie?
I don't think so. I don't think it was Dinwiddie.
And what year did you move to your present apartment?
Well, that was 18 years ago.
So that way.
So that I think that was in 1981, really,
okay.
The beginning of 1981.
Fine.
And we've been living there ever since.
Good. Okay. Now we can,
now
get
we
on
can go
with
on.
The meat of this interview.
Fine. Fine.
Obviously, we're very interested in your professional life.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you taught at Taylor Alderdice.
Right.
Is that the first place that you taught?
Yes.
Will you tell us something about
I'd be
that?
Glad to. I think I told you that during the first 15 years of my marriage, I was busy with our home and I was our children and very active in Hadassah and very active at Tree of Life and in the sisterhood and also a chairman of the education committee, active in the alumni of the University of Pittsburgh. And it dawned on me as my children were older that perhaps I should make use of my degree. So I applied for a teaching position and I was very happy to receive a position at Taylor Alderdice. the counselor that I had had at Pitt was correct. I taught bookkeeping and I taught business English. I was also sponsor of the yearbook. I helped with the debate team. And during this time, I returned to Pitt to earn my master's degree. And I was pleased to find that the award that I had earned was honored after all those years, even though that award was no longer in operation. There was just no question about it. So in 1963, I earned a degree in education and a certificate in counseling.
When you say you earned a degree in education, you mean a master's
degree? A master's degree, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you said, you mentioned that you were teaching at Taylor Alderdice.
Yes, I was
What was Taylor Alderdice like at that time? What was the physical structure?
The physical structure was very much the same it is now. Of course, right at this moment, it's only a senior high school. Then it was a junior and a senior high school. They had built an annex many years ago, and this became the junior high school. The senior high school was in the main part of the building. Since that time, they have rebuilt the building, and it is even larger, but it is only a senior high school. If I read the papers correctly, I think in a few years they're going to add the junior high school again, which I mm-hmm. think is an excellent idea.
And where is Taylor Alderdice located so we know this in the future?
At Forward and Shady Avenues.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Would you tell us something about what was business education? What did it involve at that time?
Well, business education at the time involved shorthand, typing, and bookkeeping. There were no machines the way there are today, computers and so on. And it was Greg shorthand. It was typing, learning to type on manual typewriters. And as far as bookkeeping was concerned, I guess bookkeeping will always be bookkeeping. So you learn how to add and subtract very quickly, and you learned about assets and liabilities.
And do you remember what typewriters you used? Were they Underwood?
Yes, definitely. No, we had all Underwood typewriters in the classroom that I saw. I didn't teach typing,
Okay. Do you recall what the enrollment of Alderdice was?
I don't recall the complete enrollment, but I will tell you that graduations were the senior classes were 600 and 700 students at a time. So it was like a city. I believe we had at least 3,000, maybe better than 3,000 students there at one time.
And how long did you teach at Alderdice?
3.5 years.
3.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And before we go on to the next, would you mind telling us what the discipline was like in those days?
Discipline was no problem at all, unlike today. I think children, especially children at Alderdice, were very anxious to learn. I think the parents were very education-minded. And if you had a discipline problem or two, they were minor and very easily taken care of by the office. And so I would have to say that discipline was not a problem in those days.
Tell us about the cultural composition of the students that went to Alderdice at the time you were teaching?
I would say that about half of them were Jewish and the other half were Gentile. The Gentile students coming from the Greenfield area, the Jewish students, of course, in Squirrel Hill.
Were there many blacks in the school?
No, very few. I think the black students in the school were primarily those students whose parents were working and living in some of the larger mansions in the area. However, when I was ready to leave Alderdice, which was, though I'm getting a little bit ahead of my story, maybe I'll go back and then talk about the black population at Taylor Alderdice. After I had been teaching for the 3.5 years, there was an opening for a counseling position at Taylor Alderdice, and Dr. Hal Teal, T-E-A-L, who was principal, recommended me for the counseling position. and I was very happy to accept it, even though it was for 7th and 8th grade. And so it was a challenge to go from teaching 11th and 12th graders to counseling 7th and 8th graders. But I enjoyed that very much. And I was a counselor there for 2 years before I went to the Board of Education. At the end, almost at the end of my second year, it appeared that while Taylor Alderdice was overpopulated, Westinghouse was more overpopulated, and they decided that 75 students from Westinghouse would be coming to Taylor Alderdice. And it was a volunteer situation.
What year was that?
Well, I left there in February of 1966, and that's exactly when these students were to enter, February of 1966. So while I was instrumental in helping those who were 7th and 8th graders come in and help with their scheduling, I wasn't there when they actually started school at Taylor Alderdice. So 75 students came, and they were scheduled, of course, according to their age group in whatever grade they happened to be.
And I don't believe I asked you, but what year was exactly that you came to Alderdice?
September of 1960.
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned that you went to the Board of Education. How
right.
did that all come about?
Well, that was interesting. At the end of my second year as a counselor, I received a call from Harold Heineman, who was director of personnel, and he invited me, and those are the words they used at that time when they asked you to come down to the board. They invited you to join his department as an assistant director of personnel. Tell you the truth, I was reluctant to leave Alderdice, but my family said that it would be a challenge and that I should go, and I did. I do want to tell you something that really touched me, however. The year that I left Taylor Alderdice, the Alderdice yearbook was dedicated to me. Mm-hmm. And I'll always hold a very special place in my heart for that. Anytime I think about it, I'm overwhelmed. It was just such a nice, wonderful thing for the children to do
what
for me.
What an honor.
Yes, it was an honor. Anyway, my office was at the Board of Education building on Belfield Avenue, and my job was to hire business education and home economic teachers, but really, my biggest job was mostly to hire paraprofessionals. The Elementary Secondary Education Act allowed federal money to hire paraprofessionals who were aides who were going to help teachers come into the system.
And this is what year?
This started in 1966. I think it really started in 1965, but it takes time to gear up. So by the time I got there, we were ready to do the hiring. And we placed these paraprofessionals in almost all of the schools. And it was really a wonderful thing for them, and it was a great help to the teachers. I really began to learn about the Pittsburgh Public Schools. And I need to tell you that at that time, we had about 50,000 students, we had about 6,500 employees, and we had about, well, we had 70 schools. So it was a very large job to place these paraprofessionals where they were needed. It also became apparent, and I have to go into the next part of my of my career.
Fine.
Okay.
It doesn't matter.
Fine. Because it was also in that year, 1966, that teachers had joined the Pittsburgh Federation of Teachers. Many of them had joined long before, but it wasn't that large an organization, but it was growing. And it was a union. It was unlike the Pennsylvania Teacher Education Association, which was a professional association. And many, many teachers didn't want to have anything to do with the union. But then on the other hand, they recognized that there were certain good things that the union might be able to do for them. So I think that the board recognized, since there were a number of teacher contracts already in many of the other cities, I think they recognized that something might be happening in Pittsburgh, and they decided that they had better make some preparations for this. So they retained the firm of Reed Smith, Shaw, and McClay, who explained the process of negotiations and said they would send a consultant attorney when the time was right, who would work on an hourly basis as a consultant. Now, they were very knowledgeable about blue-collar workers' contracts, white-collar worker contracts, but not professional contracts. This was something new as far as they were concerned, but they were willing to tackle it. Now, I had been working in the personnel department, as I told you, for Mr. Heineman for about 6 months when he came to my office and he asked if I would be interested in learning as much as I could about labor relations. He explained that there were contracts in many of the cities now. He also told me there was no coursework that I could take. There is now, but there wasn't then. And to learn, I would have to travel all over the United States wherever there was a contract. Well, this came as a bolt out of the blue to me. And I went home, and I will have to say that my family was very enthusiastic, and with their full cooperation, I began to travel.
Well, that's wonderful, especially when your children were young.
Yes, they were, but my children are very mature. And I have the most wonderful husband who just had a nice career of his own and wanted me to have one too. And I think we just worked together extremely well. I couldn't have done it without them. And it did work out extremely well, I'm glad to say. Anyway, I started to travel. I went as far as San Diego, I went to Chicago, I went to Detroit, I went to Cleveland, I went to Baltimore. I can't tell you, just so many, Florida, wherever there was a contract, I flew down, I spent the day with the person who would be my counterpart, and then I came home. I tried to do it in one day. I mean, I'd go early in the morning and fly home at night, you know. It wasn't until I went to New York and met with Myrtle Warner that she looked at me and said, "A woman." And I thought to myself, that's true, everyone I meet. Everywhere I went, there were men. And she said, "I'm the first woman in the United States, and I'm happy to tell you, you're the second."
What was her position?
Director of Employee Relations for the New York Public Schools.
Was this W-A-R-N-E-R or W-E-R?
W-A-R-N-E-R. And she greeted me with open arms as I greeted her. And I do have to tell you that I learned well. Everybody was so cooperative to the point that we became a club. We called each other. We helped each other when there was a problem. We even tried to meet once or twice a year to discuss various problems so that there was some continuity in what we were doing. I could learn from them because they were far ahead in years. Further ahead in years than we, you know, and it worked out very well. Anyway, when I returned from all my trips, I met the consultant attorney from Reed Smith, Shaw, and McClay, and that was Mr. James Q. Harty, H-A-R-T-Y. And it was evident that we had a lot of work ahead of us. He knew all about negotiations and nothing about public schools and teachers and schedules and budgets and all the things he had to know in order to negotiate properly. Mm-hmm. And so I took him to all the offices at the board. I took him to every high school, junior high school. There were very few middle schools then. Large elementary schools, small elementary schools, and he began to learn what he had to know, and he began to teach me what he felt I had to know. So we learned from each other. At that point, I wrote policies and procedures related to the development of management proposals in preparation for negotiations. Now I'm going to tell you that in order for teachers to have a contract, they really have to have an act passed by Congress, Pennsylvania Congress. And there wasn't any. But the board recognized that the teachers were very unhappy and decided that there was no harm in meeting and discussing problems that they might have. And that's exactly what we did. We would meet and we would discuss and we would come to some conclusions, and we even had some things in writing. Mr. Hardy is very excellent at doing that kind of thing.
Is this prior to meeting with people from the union, or
if we were meeting with the union and we were meeting with the professional group, the PTEA? We met with both of them.
Who was the person at the union who was the
president? Well, Mr. Albert Fondi, who is still the president, was the president then, and there's a Mr. Joseph Zunick and Mr. Paul Francis. These three people were very instrumental. For the PTEA, I must say they just sort of melted away because there was an election and the teachers elected the PFT to represent them. Some teachers were unhappy with that, but they went along with it. And of course, in 1970, there was Act 195, which permitted teachers to actually negotiate a contract and also, under some circumstances, to strike. And of course, then we had our first real contract, but we had had little ones before that.
I was going to ask you how you developed your approach to negotiating, but you already answered that for me. Was there anyone else at the board that you worked with?
I had a boss, Mr. Heineman, and after that, a Dr. Galligan, G-A-L-I-G-A-N. They were mostly personnel people, but it was decided that when we negotiated, we would ask some of the principals to sit at the negotiations table. We would ask a supervisor, but we would not ask the superintendent of schools or anyone higher than I was, because we felt that we could always say, well, now we have to go back to the superintendent and discuss. But we have to go to Mr. Heineman if it was a personnel matter and discuss it. It wasn't as if I was the one who was going to make the decision, but I think Mr. Hardy decided that that's the way he wanted to run it, and it made perfect sense.
It was as though you were an attorney at that point.
Well, I learned a great deal about that, because I have to tell you that while we negotiated with the teachers, we already had contracts with the maintenance workers and another one with the trades workers. Now, these are blue-collar contracts which have been negotiated by our legal department at the board. But now that I was a department, so to speak, as director of employee relations, and I had a couple of secretaries and I had clerks working for me, they decided that this should come into my department. So now there were three contracts.
And tradespersons?
Trades.
Under what category, what persons would be considered trades?
The people who actually fix the furnaces, the people who helped us put glass into the windows. We had glazers. We had repair people of all kinds. Maintenance people were the cleaners.
Yes.
But these were the people who actually kept the building in good repair.
The cafeteria workers, what would they be considered?
They came under the maintenance workers.
They did?
Yes,
okay.
They were under the maintenance workers. So now we had three contracts. It didn't take very long when the secretaries decided that they wanted a contract of their own. And then there's a group of people at the board called secretarial technical employees. And they did not want to be classed with the secretaries because they were doing financial work of a different nature and technical work of a different nature, and they wanted their own contract. And then the paraprofessionals decided they wanted a contract of their own. So now we're negotiating 6 contracts.
What about principals?
Well, principals didn't have a contract. And while we met with the principals, it was really a discussion. It was never anything in writing at that particular point in time. And to my knowledge, it has never been. It's been a handshake. It's been a discussion which led to some agreement. But it was, to my knowledge, really nothing in writing.
And the counselors and school psychologists?
They came under the teachers.
And the nurses?
Under the teachers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cindy, you were going to ask something. Also, Leah, I wondered if you could begin telling us some of your interesting experiences while you were negotiating.
Well, actually, negotiating was interesting from the point of view of sitting and talking, discussing, arguing with the PFT and with AFSCME and with the trades and so on about various things. But actually, the interesting part of my work, while negotiating sounds very glamorous, the interesting part of my work was not the negotiations. The interesting part of my work was to see that all the language that we agreed to and every agreement was expedited, and it fell to my department to do that. I'm talking about fringe benefit programs. I'm talking about classes that different, we may have negotiated for the paraprofessionals to have classes during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
I was in charge of that. I was in charge of everything that was in the agreement. And the most important thing that I was in charge of were the grievance procedures of the 6 contracts. So I heard I acted as an ombudsman for 6 contracts. Now, what do I mean by that? If a principal had a grievance, it was my job to go to the school, sit with him while the teacher sat, or the nurse, or the psychologist, or whomever was in that agreement, sat with a union representative and told us what their problem was.
Oh, you had to go directly to the school?
I had to go directly there and sit with them to make sure that they were following the agreement. And I'm really very proud of that work, and I'll tell you why. Basically, I think, and have always thought, that the most important part of my work was to see the children got a good education. And I had to keep that in front of my mind all the time. I mean, negotiating an agreement is fine, but if it isn't helping the children, then it's no use having this agreement. And I made that very clear from my point of view.
Hey, excuse me for stopping a minute. I'm afraid we're going to run out of time.
Well, if you'd like just to finish your thought, and then we probably should stop.
We can stop. It's all right. We pick it up later.